This is the current federal tax developments for the week of February the 15th, 2016. Current federal tax developments are brought to you by Nichols Patrick CP Incorporated and your State Society of CPAs. I'm Ed Zollers, and I'm going to be bringing you the developments that we have in the coming weeks in the area of federal taxes, or the coming week, I should say. We're not going to go multiple here. And this week, there's been quite a bit going on because quite a bit's been happening this week. And so we're going to talk to you about some of those things and hopefully not spend too much time, try to keep ourselves down into our standard 25-minute time period. So we'll try to keep in that range. But with that, let's go ahead and start taking a look at what is coming up for this coming week. And we're going to take a look at one of our big things coming up this week, which is something that got a lot of coverage to start the week. We had a couple of issues here. Another IRS issue with information was a problem. IRS issued a statement early this week on a statement on eFin, on the eFin, basically the e-filing, I should say, PIN. The e-filing PIN system was attacked by various automated systems in an attempt to get e-filing PINs for taxpayers. Now, we need to understand first what this is, because a lot of times, you know, there's maybe some confusion over what exactly the system was. There are three ways that taxpayers can use a personal identification number for electronic filing. The first way is called a self-select PIN, and that PIN is used if a taxpayer can provide last year's PIN that they used or last year's adjusted gross income. They can provide one of those two things, then they can select their own PIN. Now, what most of us are probably using is what's called the basically the practitioner's PIN. The practitioner PIN system is where the taxpayer signs a Form 8879, provides that to the preparer, and then the preparer submits a PIN. Therefore, the taxpayers put a PIN on this document. They've signed this document. The preparer retains that document in their files. That's evidence of filing. The third method is what the attackers went after here, and this is what's called the electronic filing PIN or e-filing PIN. This particular one is used generally by individuals filing their own return who essentially can't figure out what their AGI was last year. Since one of the requirements to use this, the IRS will tell you, is to have a copy of last year's return in front of you. One of the problems we run into is, of course, the real issue here is that these people, since last year's return were to have the AGI on it, they just don't understand what's being asked for. So they can go in and get a PIN under this system demonstrating they are who they are, and then that PIN can be used to file even if they can't fill in the information necessary to use self-select PIN. Well, as you may guess, this is an interesting way of doing it. The other problem is there is nothing here that prevents an outsider from filing, getting this electronic filing PIN, and even if they don't have the information necessarily for last year, such as the AGI, an information be needed to file a PIN, and they haven't co-opted an account of a individual who is a who basically is an e-filing participant, they can still get this and file. What happened in this case was they attacked, and just like with the transcript system, similar type of attack. They tried 464,000 Social Security numbers and were successful in 101,000 cases. Now, this is somewhat lower than their success rate a year ago, where we saw last year under the transcript system, they succeeded in about half the cases. This time, they're less than a quarter of the cases did they succeed, but nevertheless, still a fairly decent success rate. Now, what the IRS is going to do in this case is the IRS is going to notify individuals where they found this particular activity going on that third parties had their personal information and were using that to attempt to, or very possibly to actually, generate a PIN on the IRS website. Now, the good news, bad news of this is the IRS is aware of that, so they flagged those returns. The bad news is these people have the information, and filing false returns with the IRS is not necessarily the only way they could make use of that data. So if you have a client that gets this information, the bad news is, the good news is, maybe we don't have a problem with the IRS. The bad news is you may have problems elsewhere, so you need to check on all of those. Next up, development this week, we have a case here that actually comes from my home state of Arizona. This is Jones versus Commissioner. And this is an interesting case because it's not often that we get a tax court case, and this is 146 TC number 3, which was filed on February the 9th of this month, basically this week. We had February the 9th filing. And it deals with the case of a public official who is wholly or partially paid by fees. Under a special provision of the Internal Revenue Code, Section 62A2C, such a public official is allowed to take their employee business expenses above the line. They don't have to itemize. The question arose in this case about a judge. This was a Superior Court judge in Maricopa County, which Maricopa County, for those who are not aware, includes the greater Phoenix area. And the judge in this case was compensated by the county. The county paid the judge a salary. However, that salary came out of the court budget, and the court collected fees from people who litigate. You know, you have a filing fee with the court. You may pay for various other items that you file with the court. Those fees are collected. They go into the court's budget. The judge argued that because of this, he was partially paid, so he's partially compensated by fees, and as such, he should get a deduction above the line for his employee business expenses. Well, the tax court was looking at this issue for the first time, as they admitted. They really have only mentioned it in one previous case, and that was in passing. This is the first time they've really looked at the definition of what does it mean, collecting fees. And the court actually, interestingly enough, they end up quoting Emerson and Thoreau, of all things. But they then go back and take a look at a couple of other regulations that deal with public officials who are paid entirely in fees. And they determined that to be paid in fees generally means that you receive your fee directly from the general public, not that the fees go to the agency in question, and then the agency considers that part of their budget. As the court pointed out, if you follow that interpretation, virtually any public official is going to qualify for this above-the-line treatment because virtually all agencies collect fees of some sort in addition to getting amounts allocated to them from taxes. And of course, these individuals are paid out of the budget of that entity, which includes those fees. So the court decided that that wasn't the proper interpretation. Now, an interesting aside in this case was the judge in question could have taken fees for wedding. Under Arizona state law, that's a case where he would get the fee, not the county, and therefore he would be paid by fees. Now, in this case, this particular judge had waived the collection of fees in all cases for weddings, so never performed a wedding for a fee. And so the court decided it didn't have to determine if you are partially paid by fees, which you obviously would have been had he basically pocketed the wedding fees. Does that mean all of your employee business expenses go above the line, or do we have to prorate those for only the ones that are related to fees? The court made it clear that, well, that's an issue for another day. It's not an issue in this case, and the court didn't decide it. Again, this is specific to Arizona law, how this worked, how judges were compensated, but it's not all that unusual compared to how other state agencies work and other officials work. So it may be an interesting thing to take a look at. We may also want to be aware, I think a lot of people aren't even aware of this particular provision in the code for somebody paid by fees. And as the court said, it's not clear if he took $100 for one wedding, does that justify taking, let's say, $7,000 of employee business expenses above the line? Not clear. And so that's what makes this whole thing very interesting. Next up, the IRS. You may remember Congress, when they passed the Protecting Americans from Tax Hikes Act, made a number of items inflation adjusted for 2016 that had not been previously inflation adjusted. In Revenue Procedure 2016-14, issued on February the 5th, the IRS began issuing some of those inflation adjusted numbers. Now, the good news, bad news of this is the good news is we get inflation adjustment. The bad news is inflation has been running at a very high level, so most of these aren't that significant. Specifically, the inflation adjusted numbers for 179 for 2016, the amount you can expense for 2016 remains fixed at $500,000. However, the phase out did bump up by $10,000 to $2,010,000. Qualified transit benefits, well, we already knew this one. It's tied into the other benefits, so it's $255, just like the other qualified benefits that previously were, you know, that were allowed otherwise for an employer who is paying similar benefits. The above-the-line deduction for elementary and secondary school teachers will stay at $250 for 2016. Remember, however, that we did expand the definition of what qualifies for this, so that it does not have to be solely classroom expenses in 2016. So that's probably the major change there. Next up, we're going to have an IRS consideration about what happens when you guarantee the debt of a partnership that has real estate. This is Chief Counsel Advice 2016-06027, issued on February 5th. In this case, the partnership in this case owned but did not operate hotels. So it would out. So basically, it hired out the operation of the hotels. It merely held them. The chief counsel advice did conclude that the mere fact that they had hotels that they contracted out the operations of did not mean that they failed to be in the business of holding real estate. As such, the chief counsel advised determined this could otherwise qualify for qualified non-recourse debt. If you remember in the rules we're talking about at risk, if you have a principally real estate holding and you have qualified real and you have non-recourse debt, you can meet the definition of qualified non-recourse debt where the at-risk rules won't come down against you. Well, that was good news for the entity in this case, but that was kind of the end of the good news that they determined. One of the partners, one of the members of the LLC, had guaranteed the debt, issued a guarantee on debt that previously had been, you know, qualified non-recourse debt to Pearson, the way this was structured. It was debt that would otherwise qualify as that, but now one of the members had guaranteed it. The ruling notes that at that point, that member has economic risk of loss. That means this debt is no longer non-recourse. As it's no longer non-recourse, you'd have to allocate that debt entirely to the partner who has economic risk of loss. So a couple things are going to happen here. We're going to allocate that back all to the guy that made the guarantee, and we're going to take away debt and take away, therefore, basis from individuals who didn't guarantee the debt. Now, if you think about that, remember, under the rules of 752 in the code, if we have a reduction in debt allocated to a partner, that's considered a distribution of cash, which conceivably could generate for us a gain. As well, we have a reduction in amount at risk, which could mean we have to recapture prior losses. So this could be not good for the other partners. This particular partnership tried to solve this problem by having provisions that would allow the partner, you know, the one who'd guaranteed, to ask for capital calls from the other partners if he had to pay on the guarantee. The problem in the IRS's view was that the other partners weren't necessarily obligated to pay. If they failed to pay, they might lose a portion of their interest. Certain other things might happen, but there was no situation where the guaranteeing partner could sue them for actual cash reimbursement. As such, the IRS found, there was no risk of economic loss on those partners. So for that reason, those partners ended up not being considered at risk and would receive no allocation of debt. If you have a situation of this sort, it might be very useful to take a look at this particular ruling to make sure you don't run afoul of the problems. Because it's kind of interesting, and it's also important to take a look at what didn't work in trying to allocate the debt back out to the other partners. Most likely to encounter this where you go to refinance a debt that was qualified non-recourse, and the lender no longer wants to keep it that way. It's either, you know, walk away from the building now, or somebody's got to guarantee this thing. And if only one of the partners is willing to guarantee, you've got a problem. Next up, Notice 2016-19, issued on February the 11th, the IRS decided to push back the due date of the new Form 8971. It was going to be due on February 29th, 2016, for forms that would otherwise have been due on or before that date. Now we're going to push that back to March 31st. So at this point, we'll now have a new due date of March 31st for any information that would otherwise be required. This particular form added last summer, effectively the requirement to file it was added last summer by the Congress, is for any estate that was an estate that was required to file a Form 706 has to file this information reporting form with the IRS and give a copy of that information to the beneficiaries. That information is going to put down the basis that was reported by the 706. And if that particular amount, if that particular asset had the effect of increasing the estate tax paid by the estate, then they're going to be bound to use that when they later report a sale. If the beneficiary doesn't, they're subject to penalties. Well, the IRS got this form out at the beginning of this month. However, many of our tax services are just now, at least I know mine, CCH, is just now going to be releasing a version that will have it in it. And they even indicated that on one of their older version, because this could be through 2013 variants of Form 706, could have to file this, that those might not have been done by February 29th. This is going to give us some time there. As well, the IRS tells us in this notice that they're going to be issuing proposed regulations that will clarify what has to be provided and what doesn't. So because of that, the service has said, just wait until we get a notice out, and then we'll deal with it. Next up, the minimum penalty for failure to file will be increased by legislation. This is the Trade Facilitation and Trade Enforcement Act of 2015 that was issued here on February the 12th. That act is going to increase the dollar portion of the maximum penalty calculation for a failure to file that's over 60 days late. The minimum penalty currently is 100% of the tax or $135, whichever is less. After this law, after this is signed into law, the penalty will be 100% of the tax due or $205, whichever is less. It applies to any return required to be filed in calendar years after 2015. Next up, the case of Brinks, Gilson, and Leon, Professional Corporation versus Commissioner, TC Memo 2016-20. This is a firm, this was an exam of a C corporation that conceded the compensation claimed on the return was excessive. What they had done was they paid bonuses that were always equal to the percentage ownership of each of the attorneys in the law firm. And they always managed to zero out the income. Now, they agreed that they were going to treat part of this as a dividend, but they claimed we had a reasonable basis for our position. However, the tax court very clearly said we have to apply a reasonable investor test, and it does not matter that you are a professional corporation. The corporation in question had equity of nearly $10 million, and the tax court said that the investors, which would be these owners, these shareholders, would reasonably, if they were not employees, demand a reasonable return on $10 million of invested capital. And because of that, they held a portion of what they received had to be treated as a dividend, and there was no substantial authority for paying it all out. As well, they noted, they said, well, we should have reasonable cause, and reasonable cause and good faith should get us out of this because we had a major CPA firm that prepared our return. And that firm never objected to this. The court found there was no evidence they had ever asked the CPA firm about this issue. They could not rely on the CPA firm's silence as constituting advice in this area. And they had made the decision of how much compensation to pay. And for that reason, the court found there was no reasonable basis. Therefore, they owed the 20% substantial understatement penalty that is the accuracy-related penalty for substantial understatement, and they were not allowed to get out of it under either of the ways you can escape it when you trigger the magic numbers. Finally, let's take a look at the case of United States versus Titan International. This is case number 14-3789, 117 AFR 2nd, paragraph 2016-389, came out on February 1st. The IRS had previously examined the taxpayer's 2009 return and looked at its books as part of that exam. The next year came along, the IRS is now opening up an exam on 2010. They ask again to look at the 2009 books because a net operating loss was being carried in 2010. Titan objected, stating that Section 7605 states that the IRS should only be allowed a single examination of the books for a tax year unless they have a valid reason otherwise, and they have to tell the taxpayer of that reason. The tax court took a look at 7605 and said, no, we think you're misinterpreting it. The IRS has one chance per exam of a year. So their exam of the 2009 year, they can only look at the 2009 books once. If they decide to come back in on 2009, they can't go back into those books without some showing of reason why they have to go back in. When they did the 2010 return, because you're claiming a net operating loss from 2009, the IRS has a right again to go back in and take a look at the 2009 books. The court tells us about some of the differences when this does and doesn't work, but the reality is as long as there's a legitimate need for that for the 2010 return, they can go ahead and take a look at that information again, and you'll find out if you read this case, they could even theoretically go back and do a new assessment on 2009. As long as there's a legitimate reason to do it for 10, it's part of the 10 exam, they're allowed to come back in. This has been the update for the week of February the 15th, 2016. Current federal tax developments, as always, is brought to you by Nichols Patrick CPE and your state society of CPAs and is intended for your own personal use. Be sure that you go ahead and visit us on our website, currentfederaltaxdevelopments.com. We have the write-ups there of everything that we did this week. We also have links to you to the source documents for the information we considered this week. We'll also be posting information as the week goes on about what's been going on the area of taxes. And we've just added on that site the ability for you to sign up for a newsletter that'll be mailed at 4 a.m. every morning, or at least any morning, I should say, where we posted something the day before. So if you want to keep up with it during the week and don't want to visit there, you can go sign up for it online. Go ahead and be sure to come back and join us next week, as we'll find out, because I'm sure the IRS will keep busy and every, you know, other things shall happen. And we can see if the president finally signs that bill for us to discuss the developments in the area of federal taxes.